sigh says it all.
Mm-hmm.
So, everyone, we've been having so many troubles.
So many issues.
I know. We recorded this episode a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it went great. And then when we played the recording back, our voices sound like chipmunk voices.
Chipmunk voices, and then you could barely hear us. We've been having issues with computers, microphones, equipment, all around the board.
So,
it's been tough. So yeah. We're back.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Hopefully yeah. This doesn't sound like shit.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, should we get started?
Yeah. Okay. Welcome to Cocktails and Conspiracies.
Welcome,
hello.
Everyone.
Hope you miss it.
Ugh, I miss it. It's been
work has been, like, really crazy for both of us, and this is just, it's just so nice to be able to sit here and talk about something that's not
over
America, and it gets also feel productive at the same time. So, anyways, I hope everyone has been doing great, and...
Oh, you guys,
yeah.
Merch.
Yes.
We have merch. I'm wearing it right now. So we have been working so hard on finding the softest tees.
You have. You have done a great job.
Thank you. Well, I hate, like, those hard, like, crunchy cardboard cheap t-shirts that, like...
It's like the t-shirts you
have. They're not even comfortable.
Like, youth league sports.
Yeah.
You know, they're, like, stiff and thick.
Yes.
Yeah.
That go with, like, Sophie shorts.
Yes.
Yes.
I rocked Sophie shorts, though. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Did you roll them once or twice?
Oh, twice.
Me, too. We're so slutty.
If my butt's not hanging out, I don't feel good about it. As I'm sitting here in the smallest
panic
shorts right now.
But you look adorable.
Thank you.
McDub's literally wearing, like, black panties and a white crop top. But you look good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
But anyways, the shirts are awesome.
Yeah, I've never been able to rock like a conservative length of short.
No.
Like, I don't care. I'll be 40 and I'll still be wearing short shorts.
For sure.
Like,
for sure.
Jokes.
Hey, I mean, my shorts are like baby size, so I can't say anything.
Yes, she does.
I do.
And
you
do
well. Bitch.
So yeah, so we're excited. So we have two t-shirts designed.
Yes. So one's a white one. It just says Cocktails and Conspiracies Podcast. We already have the smalls sold out. Out of stock, but
that's
we're going to, I know, we're going to get a few more. And then there's a blue one that says Trust No One. And they're so soft. They wash really well.
Yeah.
That's hard as you can tear off the tag. No tags. I hate tags.
I do too.
So go on our website. We also have a new website. It's cocktailsandconspiriespodcast.com. But anyways, check out our website. A lot of fun things. We have a bunch of videos from like behind the scenes. We try and shoot a little something after each recording, so we're super wasted in all the videos,
all
but they're
them.
Fun to watch.
The
and then you can buy the t-shirts through PayPal. They're so fun.
Yes, and hey, take a picture if you buy a shirt. Take a picture of you in the shirt and tag us, and we'll put you on our Instagram.
Yeah. Oh my god, that would be amazing for sure. So, we'll put up some pictures. We tried them on for you guys so you can see, like, sizing wise, but they're like slouchy tees. So,
you
can tie them up or whatever.
Yeah. So, hopefully you guys will like it. And yeah, please post and tag us. We'd love to see you guys in these t-shirts. So today, we are talking about the Yuba County Five.
Yes. And this is from one of our favorite listeners. Thank you so much for the suggestion. Because this one was crazy. Like, I really didn't know anything about this.
It's like the American Dyatlov Pass.
Yeah.
So if you listen to that episode, it's a very...
It's kind of what it's known as.
Right.
The Americanized Dyatlov Pass.
Exactly. So, and by the way, this is still unsolved to this day.
It's crazy. Let's talk about it.
Let's do it.
Okay.
So Tessie, tell us a little bit about it and what the fuck that means.
Okay. So on the night of the 24th of February, 1978, a group of five young men who were all part of a program for the mentally handicapped, that's how they were kind of all friends through this program, all attended a college basketball game at California State University in Chico. The group of men had been anticipating their Special Olympic basketball tournament that was scheduled for the very next night in Sacramento. So basically what they were doing was having a night out, getting kind of pumped up for their game. And if they won this championship, they would all win a trip to Disneyland. Yeah. Disneyland? Yeah, Disneyland. Yeah. That's the one in California. California. So they were super, super excited about it, and they loved this team. So this is really, really weird incident because following that college basketball game, the men were supposed to drive home and, again, be ready for that game, for their Special Olympics game the next day. They all climbed into Jack Madruga's Mercury Coupe, drove to a convenience store, bought snacks, and then left the store and then vanished. They were never seen again. Right. And so the whole situation around this story is really, really weird because, A, they would never do that. They had very structured lives. And B, I mean, the guy that owned the car, Jack Madruga,
loved his car.
He loved his car. He was obsessed with it. And he wasn't one to let anyone else drive it. And where their car was eventually found, which we'll talk about later, it was like in a really, really hard place to drive, like a right. difficult place that only an expert that's used to driving. Yeah. So as a group of five young men, their ages ranged from 24 to 32. Again, they all had some sort of developmental disability. So the first guy we'll talk about is Jack Madruga. He was 30 years old and he lived with his parents in Marysville, California. He had just been laid off from his job as a busboy a few months earlier, and he had some undiagnosed mild learning disabilities. He did, however, have his driver's license. He's the one that owned the turquoise and white 1969 Mercury Montego, which was his pride and joy. And this is the car where they would take their fateful trip. And Jack had some military experience.
Right.
So that's one thing to keep in mind throughout the story. So Ted Weir is the second guy. He's 32 years old. He's from Olivehurst, California. He was tall, thin, wore thick, dark-rimmed glasses, and he was diagnosed as having a learning disability as well. So remember, this was like the late 70s.
Yeah.
So they weren't really,
I mean,
I'm sure they weren't looked into.
No, I'm not trusting like mental health.
From
the 70s. I'm really not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that there were still some of those horrible, like, mental institutions that were still, like,
God.
Up and running. Like, if y'all ever want to get into a rabbit hole of weird shit, start looking into, like, the U.S.'s history, like, especially, mm-hmm. like, in the early 1900s with, like, mentally handicapped people. It's insanely sad.
Testing them like animals.
It's crazy. The facilities, like...
Oh,
and
disgusting.
I think they still, like, there's some huge ones that are totally abandoned now that are so fucking freaky. Like,
oh my God,
it's so
that is freaky.
Weird. Yeah. So if you want to get into a rabbit hole of just weird but completely fascinating things, like, look up. Like,
yeah.
It's nuts.
Okay, so Ted lived at home as well. He had recently worked a few jobs, but he quit when his family thought his slowness was causing him problems. Another thing about Ted is he was a really sweet guy and very, like, emotional, kind of wore his heart on his sleeve, wanted to be friends with everyone, and would get, like, his feelings hurt if someone didn't wave back to him or something. To me, he just didn't understand why the world was so fucked up, because the world sucks.
And that's the thing about, like, and I don't know, like, you know, they may have been, like, mentally handicapped, but I don't know why. I don't know if some people, like, had Down syndrome. I don't know if some people had Asperger's. Like, I don't know if they, like, specify that, but I know, like...
I don't think any of them had Down syndrome.
I know with, like, Asperger's and autism and stuff like that, like, they're, you know, people that have that, they're so trusting. They're very sweet. They don't have a mean bone in their body, like, majority of the time.
Majority,
like,
yeah,
I have some,
course.
Like, some of... I have a family history of that, but they're super smart. They're awesome people, but they're very sweet.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And then another thing, like, they're very intellectual and they kind of overthink things, right? At least in this case, like, Ted, he was always known to, like, always ask questions about everything. Like, why do we have to stop at a stop sign? And, like, just would ask questions about literally everything. And then one time, they were interviewing his brother, and there was a fire at his house, and he did not, like, want to leave the house. Their house was literally burning down, and he was like, no, I need to get a good night's rest.
Yeah.
Don't want to go. Gotta sleep. Which I do love, because I love to sleep.
You do.
But...
I don't know anyone that loves to sleep more than you.
Oh, I love it so much.
How late are you going to sleep in tomorrow?
So late. I'm going to sleep all day. I can't wait. I've been thinking about it all week. So that was Ted, like, just a little on the odd side. So the next guy, Jack Hewitt, or Jackie Hewitt, he was 24. He was the youngest. He also lived in Marysville, California with his parents. and was diagnosed with learning disabilities. So Jackie was very, very quiet. This was the guy that barely spoke. And he and Ted were inseparable. BFFs. Yeah, they were best friends. So, hold on.
Take a sip.
I know. Okay, the next guy, William Sterling, he was 29, from Yuba City, California. He was very close with Jack, the driver, and very, like, a very deeply religious man who lived at home. What I mean by that is he would never want to lie. He always wanted to do everything, like,
right
by
morally
God.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So that's Bill. And the last guy, Gary Mathias.
And he will be a very interesting person in this story.
Yes. So Gary's 25 years old, from Olivehurst, California. He lived with his parents and worked for his stepfather's gardening business. He was previously in the Army. So like Jack, the driver, he was also had a little bit of military background. But he had been discharged 5 years earlier for psychiatric reasons. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and had, while in the Army, been known to have violent outbursts and a few assaults. He was on the medications Stelazine and Cognitine twice daily for his schizophrenia, and for the last few years had been doing really well. And a lot of it, in part, was because of this program. And, like, he had friends, and he had somewhat of a normal...
Support.
Yeah, a normal life.
A schedule of, you know, like, he wasn't left to his own devices. Like, he had a support system, and he had been doing well for about 2 years.
Yeah.
Because he was on the right medication, and...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, like I said before, the group of men had been anticipating their Special Olympic basketball game tournament that was scheduled for the very next night in Sacramento. They planned on attending the college basketball game to get them enthusiastic for their own game. So before they left, they neatly laid out all their basketball jerseys. Like, they were fucking ready.
They were prepared.
Yeah. And they were supposed to be home at midnight that night.
Right. So let's talk about the night they disappeared. So Friday, like you said, February 24th, they drove 50 miles to attend that basketball game. It was 50 miles away from where they lived. So like you mentioned, they, you know, the basketball game ended at 10 p.m. They stopped three blocks away at Bear's Market, which I think this is funny, mildly annoying the clerk who was trying to close up. And so that's why they remembered them, right?
Yeah.
And they bought, like, some snacks, some pies, like Snickers bars.
Like gross boy snacks.
Pepsis and then, like, milk. It's so gross.
Yeah.
But, you know, what better way to wash down a Snickers bar than with milk,
That's true, I guess.
Right?
Sweets and milk. It's pretty good.
Right. So, when they failed to return home that night, their families became extremely concerned and called the police, like, right away. Because they had no motivation to not come back. Like you mentioned, these aren't just, like, a bunch of dudes just, like, hungover and, like, just didn't come home.
Yeah.
You know?
They have to abide by this very strict, structured schedule. And so it's out of nowhere that they just didn't come home.
Right. So they never came back, and their parents never heard from them. So there was kind of, like a telephone chain, like, well, maybe, you know, Jack is with Ted, you know, with whoever. So, like, all the parents kind of called each other. It's like, hey, is, you know, blah, blah, blah at your house? No. They got to the last family and they're like, no, we haven't seen them. So they called the police. And so the police immediately respond, and the investigation is where all this weird shit comes out. So there was four main parts to this investigation. They kind of separated it out and, like, sent, like, divide and conquer kind of approach. One, a mountain search. Two, tracing movements and evidence. Three, interviewing family and friends. And then four, finding locations of witnesses that had come forward and said, like, hey, we saw this group of kids or these men, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing that happened of note was the discovery of Jack's car. So Tuesday, February 28th, 4 days later, a forest ranger found Jack's car abandoned on an unpaved road near Oroville in Rogers Cow Camp area past Elk Retreat at an elevation of about 4,500 feet. It was located 2.5 hours from Chico in the opposite direction from the route they would have been expected to drive home, and way up in the mountains in Plumas National Forest. So, I mean, right off the bat, like, why are they going in the opposite direction?
Yeah.
2.5 hours away. Like, that's a really long time to drive the opposite way you're supposed to go. Yeah.
Right? Like, you would figure it out faster than 2.5 hours.
You know, and that, like, bears the question, like, were they driving that car with somebody else?
Yeah.
So at the site of the car, police found no evidence of foul play, but the car was unlocked, one window was down, and the keys were nowhere to be seen.
Which is a really big deal, because Jack's mom said that he would never leave it unlocked. He would never leave, like, the window down. And there was, like, a bunch of, like, all those wrappers and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, candy wrappers, milk cartons, basketball programs for the car, like, kind of all over the place.
Like, trashed up.
Yeah. But there were maps left in the glove compartment. There was no obvious damage to the car, despite the bumpy, unmade road. That's important. It had around about a quarter tank of gas and was not stuck in the snow at all.
So it wasn't stuck. It didn't run out of gas.
And it didn't have any damage to the car.
That's weird.
Right. The driver had either used astonishing care and precision, the investigators figured, or else he knew the road well enough to anticipate every rut.
And it's not like Jack would probably know that road, because he never drove over there.
Right. So forest rangers searched the area for 5 days, found no trace of the men, but soon after the search began, a severe blizzard moved into the area, covering any potential tracks. Around 9 inches of snow dropped on the upper mountain. The search teams nearly lost men themselves 2 days later as their snowcats struggled through the drift. So,
Jesus.
Yeah. So the search got delayed because the conditions got so bad, right? So this discovery raised many more questions than it answered. The first was the location, far off in any direct route to Yuba County or Marysville, where they're from. None of the men's families could speculate as to why they might have driven up a long and winding dirt road on a winter night, deep into a high elevation remote forest without any extra clothing, and on the night before a basketball game they had been talking about for weeks.
Yeah.
So Jack's, the driver, his parents said he did not like cold weather, had never been up into the mountain.
So he definitely wouldn't know how to drive up there.
No, no. Bill, his father, had once taken his son to the area near where the car was found for a fishing trip, but the younger man did not enjoy it, and he stayed at home when his father went back up there. Like, he was wasn't
like,
motivated.
Like, too cold.
So those two were like, no. Similarly, police could not figure out why the men had abandoned the car in the first place.
Yeah, and this is the only thing that they found so far, is just this car. There's no other clue right now. So.
Right. So even though they were high in elevation, about where the snow line was at the time of that year, the car had become stuck in some snowdrifts, and there was evidence that the wheels had been spun attempting to get out of it, but the police said the snow was not so deep that 5 healthy young men would not be able to just push it out.
Yeah.
Right?
Really?
Right.
I feel like the car is so heavy.
I mean, with 5 guys?
Oh, yeah, and you just put in neutral. That's right.
Yeah, and just push it.
Just push it.
Why not? I could totally do it. not at all. No, if anything goes wrong with my car, I'm just done. So, here, okay. So, like, you know, the police are like, look, they should have been able to push it out. It wasn't that big of an effort. Then again, another thing. Like I mentioned earlier, the keys weren't there, suggesting at first that the car had been abandoned because it might not have been functioning properly with the intention of returning later with help. But the police hotwired the car and it started immediately. Like I said, the gas tank was a quarter full. And then the questions continued after the police towed the car back to the station for a more thorough examination. The car's undercarriage had no dents, gouges, or even mud scrapes. Not even on the low-hanging muffler, despite having been driven a long distance up a mountain road with many bumps and ruts. So, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
So, either somebody's really careful or somebody really familiar with the road, and a familiarity that Jack would not have had. He's never been up there.
He would not hated the cold.
Right. And his family was like, he wouldn't have let anybody else drive it either.
I know, that's the really so weird thing.
So, I mean, for me, my gut tells me, like, those guys were not in that car on that mountain.
Really?
Yeah.
Well.
We'll see.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of other shit that would support that.
So, 4 days later, they found the car, and then the snowstorm hit, but no trace of the men were found other than the car at that point. So, moving away from the car, here's another interesting part of the case, like the sightings of these guys. So, in response to local media coverage of the case, police received reports of some or all of the men being sighted after they left Chico. All the leads were easily knocked down until June. So February, March, April, May, June. In a desperate move, the officers even turned to psychic mediums who led them on wild goose chases. So there was one psychic that wasn't officially asked, but she had actually like offered her services to this police force in Yuba County before. So she asked the parents to give her articles of clothing or belongings to the men, and so she had this like, I don't know, not a seance, but like she had this like meeting with them, like with the family, and like they were in this room and she had all the belongings from the guys, and she ran her hands over clothing belonging to the boys. She closed her eyes and said she could see people gathered together in a shack or a cabin in a woody, hilly area near water. She saw a row of men that looked like they were tucked into something that looked like sleeping bags in a line. And so the family got their hopes up. They're like, oh, are they alive? And she's like, I can't tell you if they're alive or not. I just see them in these bags in a cabin near water.
Crazy.
I know, fucking weird.
Wow.
So other mediums told the police that the boys had been kidnapped to Arizona and Nevada. Another one said the boys had been murdered in Oroville in a two-story red home, brick or stained wood with a gravel driveway, and the number was 4723 or 4753.
All these mediums have like completely very different stories.
Very different, and then like weirdly specific for that one.
So many.
So for two solid days, they drove every street in Oroville looking for that house, and it didn't exist. So
they actually took, like, their advice and shit.
I think they were getting desperate at this point, right? So some of the sightings, like I said, most were easily dismissed, but two stood out. So this guy, Joseph Shones of Sacramento, told police he inadvertently wound up spending the night of February 24th and 25th.
Oh, my God. This is so weird.
Yeah.
The story near of Joseph Shones.
Yes. Near where the car was found, the boy's car. So that was obviously the night of their disappearance. He had driven up in that area where he had a cabin to check the snowpack in advance of a weekend ski trip with his family. At 5:30 p.m., about 150 feet up the road, he too had gotten stuck in the snow.
And this was the exact same day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just a little bit earlier.
Earlier in the day.
Right. It was about 4.5 hours or maybe 5 hours earlier because, you know, the game ended at 10 and then they ended at 2.5 hours. So it was about 7 hours earlier. Okay.
But it's just so weird because this is such an isolated area.
Right.
And this is, okay, keep going.
What, you know, like, what are the odds, right?
Yeah.
So in the process of trying to free his own car, he realized he was beginning to experience the early symptoms of a heart attack and went back inside his car and kept the engine running to provide heat.
Ugh, Joseph.
Ugh, what a fucking nightmare. What a
horrible night.
6 hours later, lying in the car and experiencing severe pain, he told police he saw headlights coming up behind him. Looking out, he saw a car parked behind him, headlights on, with a group of people around it, one of which seemed to be a woman holding a baby. He called to them for help, but then they stopped talking and turned their headlights out. Sketchy.
So sketchy.
So do not want to be, like, noticed.
Hello, I'm having a heart attack. Can you come help me?
Help.
Help.
later, he saw more lights from behind him, this time flashlights, then also went out when he called to them. So, like, twice in this, like, six-hour ordeal, like, he saw a car come up, asked for help, saw flashlights, like, moving flashlights, called for help. They went out, too. After that, Shen said at first he recalled, oh, so this is important. So remember this. So the weirdest part about this, not the weirdest, but like a important part about this story is this pickup sighting. So we're going to talk about that right now. So after, you know, his two attempts to get help that he didn't get, he recalled a pickup truck parking about 20 feet behind him briefly.
But this is the same.
Same night. Like
the same car.
No. Like, this is a different. This pickup truck is different.
So the first car was the Montego.
Well, we don't know that, but it wasn't the pickup. The truck. Okay. Right. He recalled a pickup truck parking 20 feet behind him and then continuing on down the road.
God, two people ignoring this guy. Well, three now.
Like, geez, right?
Poor thing.
I know.
Oh.
Then it just continued down the road after it parked behind him briefly. Later, he clarified to police that he could not be sure of that since at the time he was almost delirious from the pain he was in. After Sean's car ran out of gas in the early morning hours, so that would be the morning of February 25th, his pain subsided enough for him to walk 8 miles down the road to a lodge. Yeah, I would not even walk 8 miles right now.
I would give up 100%.
2 miles is my tops.
Just kill me.
Come on. Done. I just lay in the snow, like, go to sleep and get hypothermia and, like, yeah. Just be done.
Ideally.
That's the best stuff. Okay. So he marched 8 miles down the road to a lodge where the manager of that lodge drove him back home, passing the abandoned Montego at the point where he recalled hearing the voices originate from. So that's when, like, with the manager driving him home, that's when he's like, oh, yeah, that's the car from the first one. Like he did pass, like, the Montego. So doctors actually did later confirm that he experienced a mild heart attack. But Ted's mom said ignoring someone's pleas for help was not like her son. If he indeed had been present, like, if he was a part of that group that he, like, one of the three, you know.
Joseph saw, yeah.
Yeah. She recalled how him and Bill, so Ted and Bill.
Bill's the religious one. Ted's the sweetheart.
Yes. She actually recalled at one point that Ted and Bill had helped someone they knew get to the hospital after overdosing on Valium. So, like, they're helpful. Like, yeah. they're not going to be scared of somebody needing help.
Yeah.
So, because of this story, because of Joseph, and the fact that he hiked 8 miles and having a heart attack.
Right.
Most people hoped the boys could have hiked, too, if they were indeed there on the mountain.
Yeah.
Another notable report was from a woman who worked at a store in the small hamlet of Brownsville, 30 miles from the spot where the car had been abandoned, you know, with all the wrappers and the things that they had bought. The woman said she identified the men immediately as from out of the area due to their, and I'm quoting, big eyes and facial expressions. Two of the men, whom she identified as Jack and Bill, so she recognized Jack and Bill, she said that they were in a phone booth outside of the convenience store while the other two men went inside. Police said she was a credible witness and they took her account seriously. So additional information came from the store owner who corroborated her account. He told investigators that men whom he believed to be Ted and Jackie came in and bought burritos, chocolate milk, and soft drinks. Ted's brother told the Los Angeles Times that while driving to Brownsville in a different car, an apparent ignorance of the basketball game seemed completely out of character for them.
Yeah.
The owner's description of the two men's behavior seemed consistent with them, however, as Ted would eat anything he could get his hands on. That's what his brother said. And was often accompanied by Jackie more than any of the other four. However, Jackie's brother said that he hated using telephones to the point that he would handle his brother's call from the other men in the group. So, like, even with his own friends, like, he hated, like, being on the telephone. So, yeah. Like, why would he be in the phone booth?
Yeah.
Right? So, it's just, like, too. It's just a lot of inconsistencies. It's weird stuff. Like, why would they be in another truck? Like,
yeah.
What the fuck? Like, so.
But it kind of makes sense because why would they even be in that area in the first place? Like, who knows what the fuck happened?
Everything was all on its head. Right. So, let's talk about the actual discovery of them. So this was the investigation. We talked about the weird sightings and like some of the like different approaches that they did to like really dig into this case. And I mean, they did a great job. I mean, they didn't like just half-ass this.
No, they were very, very into this whole case, and it lasted a really long time. I mean, they went months and months without finding a body or finding really any clues.
Right.
So a couple months later, on June 4th, with most of the higher elevation snow melted, a group of motorcyclists went to a trailer maintained by the Forest Service at a campsite off the road about 20 miles from where the Montego had been found.
Mm-hmm.
A front window had been broken, and so they decided to go in, I guess, to check it out. And when they opened the door, they were overcome by the odor of what turned out to be a dead body.
I hope I never smell a dead, decomposing body. But, like, everyone that I've ever listened to that has, like, it is so distinct. Like, you'll never forget that smell.
Oh, that's so crazy. Ugh.
Ugh.
So, this body was later identified as Ted Weir's. So searchers returned to Plumas following the road between the trailer and the site of the Montego. The next day, they found remains later identified as Jack Madruga and Bill Sterling on opposite sides of the road, about 11 and a half miles from where the car had been. So Jack's body had been partially consumed by scavenging animals, and only bones remained of Bill Sterling, and they were all scattered over a small area. Autopsy showed that they had both died of hypothermia. Deputies speculated that one may have succumbed to the desire for sleep that marks that condition's final stages, and the other refused to leave his side, eventually meeting the same fate.
Oh.
Which is, like, so sweet.
It's heartbreaking.
So sad.
Yeah.
2 days later, as a part of one of the other search parties, Jackie Hewitt's father insisted on helping the police in the search because, you know, they had found three bodies already, and there were only two left. And so Jackie Hewitt's father was like, no, I want to help. I want to find, you know, my son's body or whatever.
Yeah.
During the search, they were walking around, and he had found his son's blue jean jacket in the snow and immediately recognized it. So he ran to pick it up, and a backbone fell out of the jacket.
God. It's awful.
I know. And so this was about 2 miles northeast of the trailer. So his shoes and jeans nearby helped identify the body. The next day, a deputy sheriff found a skull downhill from the bush 300 feet away, confirmed by dental records later to have been Jackie Hewitt's. His death, too, was attributed to hypothermia. And this is weird again because he was very, very close to that trailer where Ted had been found, and
right.
Those were the two inseparable ones. In an area to the northwest of the trailer, roughly a quarter of a mile from it, searchers found three Forest Service blankets and a rusted flashlight by the road. So
remember the flashlight.
Remember the flashlight, and remember the woman with the baby.
Joseph Shones saw people with flashlights.
Yes.
That actually just gave me goosebumps. That
it's so weird.
Creeps me out.
So it couldn't be determined how long those items had been there. But again, they had, they had pretty much searched that area, like, mm-hmm. and with the snow and everything, like, it made sense for those items to have been there around the same time. So since Gary Mathias had presumably not taken his medication, pictures of him were distributed to mental institutions all over California. However, no trace of him has ever been found. So we found four dead bodies,
weird.
But we never found Gary Mathias. And I know you're going to talk about that a little bit. So let's talk about the evidence in the trailer. So we found those four dead bodies, but let's talk about the weird things around it.
Yeah.
So Ted Weir's body was on the bed in that trailer with 8 sheets wrapped around it, including the head. So he was like kind of
wrapped up like
a mummy. Yeah. The autopsy.
You can't wrap your own head like that. After
no, this
body
was someone
wrapped.
Else doing it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The autopsy showed that he had died of a combination of starvation and hypothermia. He had lost nearly half of his 200-pound body weight. The growth of his beard suggested that he had lived as long as 13 weeks from when he had last shaved, which was like, you know, probably at the most 12 weeks after they disappeared,
right?
His feet were badly frostbitten, almost gangrenous. On the table next to the bed were some of Ted's personal effects, including his wallet with cash, a nickel ring with the word Ted engraved on it, and a gold necklace he wore. And also on the table was a gold watch without its crystal, which did not belong to anyone in that group. And there was a partially melted candle, which is kind of weird. There was a propane gas tank in that trailer, and there was a lot of food, like canned food.
Yeah.
So his reasons for death, like starving to death and freezing, like, it doesn't make any sense.
No, like, a Yuba County lieutenant named Lance Ayers said that all they had to do was turn the gas on, and they could have had gas to the trailer and heat. And then even if they didn't know how to do that, there was heavy clothing, matches, playing cards, books, wooden furniture, and other materials that could have easily been used to start a fire. But there had been, like, no attempt to do that.
And then the weird thing is, if you can light a candle, you can light a propane tank, right?
Right, of course.
This was the most puzzling thing to the investigators, because despite their, you know, mental disabilities, they would have been able to figure something like this out. So no fire had been set in the trailer's fireplace, despite an ample supply of matches, paperback novels. Again, they had that lit candle right by his bed. There was heavy forestry clothing, which could have kept the men warm.
Yeah. Like I said, like, so many materials that you could have burned things. If you didn't know how to turn that tank on.
Yeah. There was a dozen sea ration cans from a storage shed outside that had been open and their contents consumed. But there was a locker in the same shed that held an even greater assortment of dehydrated food, enough to keep all five men fed for a year, if that had been necessary, that had not even been opened. But, like, the rest of the cans had. Ugh. It just makes no sense. Similarly, another shed nearby held a butane tank with a valve that, had it been open, would have fed the trailer's heating system. So the way that you had to open those cans of food is with a P-38 can opener, which is a very specific can opener that you really...
To the Army.
Yeah, you really only learn how to use it if you're in the military or in the Army. And Matthias would have known how to use it, and so would Jack. Another weird thing. Ted's shoes weren't on, so they were just, like, taken off his feet. And Matthias's tennis shoes were in the trailer.
So why were their shoes off?
Because maybe he took Ted's shoes. Maybe he took his shoes off and put Ted's shoes on. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. Greg Matthias, his feet were probably also swollen from frostbite. And again, this is all us deciphering.
It's conjecture because nobody's found unsolved. Matthias.
So instead, if he decided to venture outside, maybe he put on Ted's heavier shoes. The sheets all over Ted's body suggested that one of the others had been there with him, as his gangrenous feet would have been in too much pain for him to pull them over his body himself.
He got the gangrene in his feet.
So Ted probably wasn't alone. So even if he did lack common sense, like, someone else was there with him.
And it could have been one of the boys, or it could have been somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we don't know. We don't know whatever happened to Greg Matthias.
Right.
So those are the discovery of the bodies. Super, super sad.
So I have some quotes from, like, after this discovery. So Jack Madura's mother said, "There was some force that made them go up there. They wouldn't have fled off in the wood like a bunch of quail. We know good and well that somebody made them do it. We can't visualize somebody getting the upper hand on those five men, but we know it must have been." And, like, Ted's sister-in-law said they saw something at that game at the parking lot. They must have seen it and didn't realize they'd seen it. Like, something happened by the time the game was done and by the time they got, you know, the food in their own car.
Yeah.
And then they got the food again, like, you know, with the truck. Like, it's just something, somebody manipulated them. Somebody forced them to.
What do you think could have happened?
I
do you think it happened? Do you think someone, like, threatened
honestly,
them at the game?
I think that they were manipulated. I think, like,
do you think that happened at the game, or do you think that happened after?
Maybe they ran into these people and then they, you know, maybe they made them feel safe and was like, "Hey, look, like, maybe manipulated them, like, beyond their, like, desire to go home and then, like, trick them. But for what reason? Maybe, you know, like Todd's sister-in-law was like, they had to have seen something they shouldn't have seen.
Yeah. Because I think the weirdest thing to me is Ted's beard.
Well,
that
he was alive for
so long. Yeah, I mean,
let's talk about, like, what's weird about this case. Like, so...
Everything.
Right. So here's an outlier. So in this case, that makes very little sense. One aspect seems logical. Of course, they would have all spent their last Friday night together. The men have been friends for years, and one was rarely found without another by his side. So that's one thing we can take away from this case. Like, they would never, like, separate. And if one did something, another would do it too.
Yeah.
Like, they would stay together. Like, nobody's like, well, fuck this. I'm not being a part of this. I'm leaving. Like, they're not gonna, like,
Gary act. Matthias, maybe, because maybe he left.
Maybe. But that's one aspect that seems logical, is, like, they're not gonna act independently from each other because they've been inseparable, you know?
Yeah.
So why is a very, very common question for investigators and the relatives of these men. There's been no answers that were forthcoming. So here's some questions. Why did the men turn east in the first place? Why didn't they attempt to move the car once it got stuck instead of walking to nowhere in the middle of the night? Was it by chance they came across the trailer, or did somebody lead them there? Why not start a fire for warmth? If Gary Matthias went for help, where is his body? So, police never ruled out foul play, nor did the families. So, Jack's mother, the driver, she told the Washington Post that she believed some force, like I said earlier, led the group astray. We've talked about this before. She said it would be impossible for her to believe that Jack would ever drive his car, which he prized, into an area that might be damaged. She said, I'm positive he never went up there on her own, she told the paper. He was either tricked or threatened.
Yeah.
And which I believe that.
I believe that too.
Yeah. So, then here's some more questions, like, you know, what happened around that car? Like, how did the group end up in that trailer 20 miles away from that car? I mean, they could have walked because Jack Jones did, you know, about half that with a heart attack.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. Did they walk 20 miles to that trailer? I mean,
they had to have, right? And then why did Ted starve to death? You know, like, he had all that food and...
But he didn't know how to use that can opener.
Sure. So here's the official, like, I have an official theory and then some information about Gary Matthias. So Ted's sister-in-law, like I said earlier, she theorized that they might have seen something at the basketball game or somewhere in between that promoted someone to chase them. Police were never able to establish evidence for pursuit, but no one could shake the idea that the men seemed to be determined to move forward. Why do that unless something more frightening was right behind them? Like, why... Something had to scare them, or they had to feel threatened or highly manipulated in some way to get them out of their plan. Like, yeah. Their sink. Like, they
again, these guys all had very structured lives.
Day, right.
And they had that game.
Right. So there's a publication called The Bee.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, it's a two-part article. It's a really great, like, they cover this in depth. So this newspaper was given permission to access police records from the case as long as they didn't take pictures or take them out of Yuba County Sheriff's Office, since this is still, like, an open case, right?
Yeah.
So they were able to go there and, like, just, like, review them, like, in real time and then, like, go away and take information, like, you know, take their knowledge out. The Bee found information in records that would indicate that it is possible that Gary Matthias was not as portrayed in the media after the disappearance. So here's the description that they gave in the article. These files, clips, and interviews shape a disturbing image of Gary Matthias, billed in virtually all media reports at the time as another lost lamb caught out in the cold. Gary was an aberration within a flock, a young man who did not belong with the others. He was violently schizophrenic and had a history of drug use and wasn't intellectually disabled like the others.
Okay.
So, you know, we mentioned this before at the top of this podcast that Gary Mathias didn't have any documented mental intellectual disabilities in the same way as the other four did. He was a football player in high school, served in the military following graduation. He had a problem with drugs, first put into a psychiatric facility during his sophomore year of high school after a bad hallucination trip. He would later be medically discharged from the military for paranoid schizophrenia, like we said.
I bet it was drugs.
I don't know. So, I don't know, because we'll get to that. So, after being just discharged, he went really downhill because structure helps, right?
Yeah.
He was in jail. He called a guard over and punched him in the face that same month after he got out of jail. And I don't know why he was in there. I think he was, like, it was a minor offense. Gary was staying at his cousin's house, and his cousin's wife was sleeping after taking medication for, like, an illness. His cousin, after worrying why a bathroom break was taking so long, like, so his wife, like, or I guess he went to the bathroom. I think Gary went to the bathroom, and he was, like, gone for a really long time in the house. The cousin caught Gary fondling his wife when she was, like, asleep.
Oh, my God.
So.
Ew.
Isn't that fucking gross?
Yeah.
After his cousin told Gary he was calling the police, Gary proceeded to tell his cousin that he wanted to return to jail. Structure, right? Like, you know what I mean? He was later arrested a few months later for threatening to stab a woman in the jaw and then telling the woman's 3-year-old child that I thought I'd kill you once. I guess I'll have to do it again.
Jesus Christ.
He had a history of breaking out of facilities and walking really long distances. So this is really important. He would go on these, like, really long, like, walkabouts. After being arrested, at one point, he was sent to a psychiatric facility. He spent 2 days there before breaking out through a drainage pipe. Like,
what the fuck?
Yeah, like...
like Alex Mack?
Yeah, exactly. Just puddling out of the facility, for sure.
How do you escape through a drainage pipe? Aren't they, like, that's skinny?
Like, I don't know.
Because it's so dirty.
And then he walked and hitchhiked 80 miles back home.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. At one point, he also left his home to go live with his grandmother in Northern Oregon. His mother begged him to return home, yet he hung up the phone on her. Then he showed back a few weeks later, filthy, and claimed he had walked from Portland stealing milk off of porches and eating dog food to stay alive on the 540-mile trip. So what? He claimed to have, like, made that on foot.
Oh, my God.
So the final violent incident occurred a few weeks before, after his trip back home. So he made that, like, long journey, and then a couple weeks later, he broke into a home of a local couple, and the couple awoke to find Gary standing in their bedroom, which is, like, my fucking worst nightmare.
Oh, my God.
He told them that he was looking for a ring to return to Saturn. Was looking for a ring to return to Satan, not Saturn. I think Saturn would be, like, much better.
Yeah.
And that they also owed him rent money. Like, he's fucking rent nuts. Money.
Yeah.
So, after that, like, I guess that was, like, the rock bottom for him. He supposedly straightened out. He joined the Gateway Projects, which all the men were a part of.
That's how they all met.
Right. And became friends with them. Despite his seemingly, like, 180 degree change, some were still wary of him.
Well, so, yeah.
Following a 1978 interview with Gary Mathias's longtime acquaintance, Janet Enzera, Yuba County Sergeant James Black wrote that Gary had repeatedly told Janet of a dream where he and several other people would disappear. Janet called Gary a very violent person, hurting several men seriously, and said that he also hates women, according to this, the Yuba County Sergeant James Black interview notes.
Who's Janet?
It's his longtime acquaintance of Gary. Like, so she's known him for a long time.
Yeah.
And they interviewed her, like, James Black did. A brother of one of the victims also notes that the Mathias family was weird following the disappearance.
So in this article, the Bee also states, no one pulled a trigger on the boys, but something or someone killed them. Asked if he thought Gary had set his brother and the others up to die, the official stance was like, that's the only thing that makes sense. So, so Unsolved Mysteries, which was like in the 1990s, actually sought, it was a TV show, sought the
involved. Everyone knows what Unsolved Mysteries is. It's the fucking best show.
It is the best.
Love it.
That and Forensic Files, I can just watch.
So good.
The best.
Same.
I love those like old-fashioned reenactments too. Like,
yes, so dramatic.
I was like, I wonder, and they're so bad acting. I was like, I wonder
so
how
bad.
Much these people get paid to like reenact like crime scene shows.
Nothing.
They're just hoping for that.
Yeah.
So Unsolved Mysteries, they did an episode. They wanted to do an episode on this, and they sought like the family's permission to do an episode on the missing five. So every family agreed except Gary's. Despite him still being missing.
That's so weird.
So Gary's surviving siblings declined to comment, and they could not be reached by the Bee.
Wow. Yeah. You would think that they would, like, want to be involved.
Right. So
figure out what the fuck happened.
Right. So Todd's sister-in-law said, that's just suspicious. I'm not saying they knew, but, well, you can probably guess what I think. Like,
yeah.
And he's still missing. So you would think like families would be involved in keeping this story going because he's still missing. And, you know, maybe they knew something, maybe they didn't, but they definitely acted weird.
Yeah. Where the fuck is he?
Yeah. So I think that's like kind of the official theory. Like people, like the police are very suspicious of Gary, but here's another weird fucking story from this. If it couldn't get any weirder, about 3 weeks after the boys went missing, a Yuba City woman named Debbie Lynn Reese picked up the telephone. Investigator said, hello, she said. I know where the missing five men are. A man on the other end of the line said before hanging up. So somebody called her.
3 weeks later?
3 weeks after the disappearance. Somebody okay. called Debbie Lynn Reese.
Okay.
And the voice said, I know where the missing five men are. And the same guy called back the next day, Debbie told authorities, and said, I need help because I really hurt those guys bad. When she asked, who did you hurt? He replied, don't play dumb with me, and hung up.
Oh, I know who it was. I mean, that sounds like a schizo to me.
Yep. There was one more call the next day on March 17th. The man said, those five guys are all dead. They're all dead, Debbie asked.
Five guys? He said five guys?
Okay. Yeah. They're all dead, he repeated. Then he hung up, and she never heard from him again. So the main investigator doesn't think it was Gary, though. Gary couldn't get his medication if he went off the grid, and he couldn't stay out of trouble without his medication. Then there was his family ties. So even on his long walkabouts, he always came back to his mom and his stepfather's house.
Oh, that's so weird. I don't know now.
I don't know. So I guess, like, final thoughts on this, like...
I mean, I do think that Gary was sketchy as fuck. I think that...
He had issues.
Whenever you have schizophrenia and... Or bipolar or any type of mental... Like, psychotic, psychiatric... I don't know what you would call it.
You just do crazy things. Like,
yeah.
You have a different sense of logic.
Yeah, exactly. And that can be really, really detrimental. And he was obviously off his meds.
Obviously. Like, for that many weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think... I don't know. So, okay, I guess, like, the two theories could be, like, okay, like, Gary did something. But what did he do to get them there? I mean, obviously... So, I could kind of go with the Gary theory because they trusted him.
Yeah. And then maybe he snapped.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe
but then what's the truck? So, I don't know. This is just...
The truck and the woman with the baby
so
and the baby clothes.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's similar to DLF Past. There's not as many, like, you know, otherworldly, like, theories, conspiracy theories about this. But it's, like, this is absolutely, absolutely bizarre. And I guess, like, from a conspiracy standpoint, like, you know, that whole area. Like, watch that documentary, Murder Mountain, on Netflix. It's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
You don't know who you're going to run into, like, in that area.
Do you think they could have picked up a hitchhiker?
Maybe.
And then that's what happened?
Maybe.
Or, like...
I didn't even think about that.
Gary, like, just really, because he was involved with drugs. Maybe he, like, got drugs at the game or something. And
but it had been 2 years.
I know, but yeah. Addiction's
very Addiction, common. Right. I know. So,
I don't know.
This is one that's completely stumped me. I'm gonna quote, it's a bizarre. It's the it most bizarre. Fucking it's weird. Bizarre as fuck. It doesn't make sense. Like, nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
But I could see, I do agree with you, like, I could see, like, why they wouldn't utilize the resources at the trailers because they didn't think that way.
Yeah.
That's really weird, and it's like, oh my god, why? But, and they didn't, I don't think there's any evidence of, like, restraint or, like, bodily harm or anything like that.
Because you even tell they're all bones.
Right.
When they found them.
I don't know. So, I mean, I could see why they didn't utilize the resources or didn't know how to heat the cabin or whatever, because it's like, they probably had their families do everything for them.
Yeah.
Their whole lives. So, I could see that, but I don't understand, like, the truck. I don't understand why they went so far in the opposite direction with a strict schedule.
But if they ate half the food, why didn't they just continue eating that food?
Maybe the person that knew how to open the food left.
Left. Gary, he probably left.
Yeah.
And then Ted was just fucked. He was probably wrapped him around and was like, I'm going to borrow your shoes and go get help, and took the can opener with him.
Or maybe he already, do you think he already died and he just wrapped him up so he couldn't see him and then took his shoes and left?
Maybe.
Because why would his head be wrapped up if he was still alive?
Oh, I don't know. But remember his beard? So his beard growth, Ted's beard growth, the one that was found in the cabin on the bed, they said that he was probably alive, you know, 3 months.
So after maybe, he like, they were there in that trailer, but I don't know why Ted wouldn't have left. But I get, maybe he died and, like, Ted wrapped him up, took his shoes, and left.
Yeah. But how did they all get split up?
I don't know. Maybe they, like, the others died earlier.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't make it through that hike. So, okay, whenever we post this, leave your comments.
Yeah.
This is so fucking weird.
It's so weird. And the weirdest thing is the Gary Mathias thing, that his family, like, won't help us.
Right.
Like.
I know.
Throw me a freaking bone here.
Throw me a bone.
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyways, that's the Yuba County Five.
Yeah. Yeah, and let us know your thoughts, seriously, because I want to know what everyone thinks.
Yeah,
because I have no...
I had no clue.
No clue.
Glad I'm not an investigator.
Mm-mm.
I'd be stumped.
Yeah, this is a tough one.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we're hoping this works.
Yeah, I think it did.
I think it did, too. So hopefully we're going to be back and keep feeding us your ideas. Like, we've been doing, like, listener requests the whole time. We have some really cool stuff coming up.
We do.
Order your merch. They're the best.
Yes. Go on our website. Look under merch and order yourself a cute, soft tea. You'll love it.
That's right. Should we do a guy version?
Yeah, we probably should.
Okay.
Yeah.
Men's coming soon.
Yeah. I mean, a man can wear it probably, but it's a women's shirt.
It is. Men can fit in it.
Yeah.
You want a deep V? Do you want to show off that chest hair?
Slouchy, soft.
Slash pecs? Go for it.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well.
Well, we love you. God bless you. And trust no one. Bye.
Bye.